It gives me great pleasure to welcome our distinguished speaker here tonight. The Baroness Dunn is Executive Director of John Swire & Sons Limited. Baroness Dunn was educated at St. Paul's Convent School in Hong Kong and the University of California at Berkeley. She joined the Swire Group in Hong Kong in 1963 as an executive trainee and has been director of John Swire & Sons United Kingdom since 1978, of Swire Pacific Limited since 1981, and Cathay Pacific Limited since 1985. Before she moved to London in 1996 to join the Swire Group's parent board, Baroness Dunn was senior member of the Hong Kong Executive and Legislative Councils, among other public service jobs. In her work on these bodies, she advised successive governors on the formulation of government policies and participated in the enactment of legislation. She was also chairman of the Hong Kong Trade Development Council, the statutory body responsible for the promotion of Hong Kong's external trade. This is the order of her ascent. Baroness Dunn was made an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, OBE, 1978, Commander, CBE, 1983, Dame Commander, DPE, 1989. She was made a life peer in 1990. Baroness Dunn has received numerous trade awards from the governments of Japan and the United States. She's also received honorary doctorates from a number of universities, including Leeds University, Buckingham University, and the University of British Columbia. The title of Baroness Dunn's lecture tonight is Hong Kong and Asia in the New Era. Baroness Dunn.
Thank you. It is a great personal pleasure to be here this evening to celebrate the inauguration of the Sir John Bremeridge Chair. I had the privilege of knowing and working with John Bremeridge for over 20 years. I first met John when I joined the Swire Group in Hong Kong in 1963. John was then a senior executive of the group. He later became chairman in Hong Kong. As a starry-eyed, inexperienced trainee just out of university, I was terribly intimidated when I first met this unusual man. He was intelligent, witty, well-read, somewhat bumptious, a lateral thinker, with a clever sense of humor. But it did not take me long to discover his qualities of kindness, integrity, and sensitivity. He always went out of his way to make staff feel at ease and to give encouragement. And he was loyal. An important and demanding American principal once went to John to complain about a company for which I was responsible. And John sent for me. I still remember his words. "I want you to know," he said, "that if it comes to a choice between this account and you, I don't mind losing the account." And it was an overwhelming gesture of support, particularly considering the margins we got from that account. He and I later became colleagues in the Hong Kong Legislative and Executive Councils. John's contributions inside and outside the council chambers were legendary for their depth, wisdom, and judgment. When he retired from the Swire Group in 1981, he became the first person ever from the private sector to be appointed Hong Kong's financial secretary. He presided over one of the most difficult periods in Hong Kong's history, the worst world recession for 50 years, a run on the Hong Kong dollar, the collapse of the Hong Kong property market, a succession of crises in the banking sector, uncertainty over Hong Kong's relationship with China. But when he retired 5 years later, Hong Kong was in budgetary surplus, its currency stable, and its exports booming. John is perhaps best remembered for his decision to establish the link between the Hong Kong dollar and the US dollar exchange rate. This single step stabilized the currency at a time of monetary crisis. It has underpinned international confidence in the Hong Kong currency ever since. But he is remembered too for his humanity. He used to say that, and I quote him, a good budget is not just a string of figures. It is the stuff of people's lives. Neither would he forget the importance of looking after all members of society. He was endeavoring to create, he said, the possibility of self-improvement for the successful and the certainty of sensitive treatment for the unsuccessful. Above all, I think John's strong personal conviction was the same as the ethos which lies behind the success of Hong Kong and other Asian countries. I quote his words, "We can do little to help ourselves beyond prudent management of public finances and reliance on market forces and on the vigor of our properly motivated entrepreneurs." It is this underlying philosophy which transformed Hong Kong from a depopulated wreck after the Second World War to the world's seventh largest trading economy today. Its airport and container port are the busiest in the world. It has the world's most liberal economy. Its GDP per capita of over $26,000 is higher than Britain, Canada, and Australia. The list goes on and on. Hong Kong's success has not, of course, been an isolated one. Its economy has grown with other Asian tigers. They, in turn, invest their export-led surpluses in neighboring economies to take advantage of their low cost of land and labor. In so doing, they provide the impetus for growth in their neighbors, creating for these neighboring economies the prospect of their own growth and prosperity. Living standards of people in Asia have quadrupled within a generation. In the last 20 years, the region enjoyed a sustained economic growth rate of 7 to 8%. Compare this to the world average of 3.5% and industrial countries of 2.1%, and you start to get a sense of the region's achievements and its potentials. The World Bank estimates that East Asia's share of world GNP has risen from 10% in 1960 to 30% in 1990 on the basis of purchasing power parity. It predicts that by the year 2010, Asia's combined economy will be larger than either Europe or North America. In a unique way, the Asian economies and Asian markets complement each other, stimulate each other, and supply each other. The region has its producers of capital in Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore. Its producers of raw materials in Indonesia and Malaysia. Its low-wage economies in China, India, Myanmar, and Vietnam. Above all, it has its own vast growing consumer market. As John Bond, the chief executive of HSBC Holdings, said, It is a virtuous cycle of development unlike anything seen anywhere else in the world. This is all the more remarkable when viewed against the region's diversity and political and historical barriers. Asia's 3 billion people come from a vast range of ethnic groups. They speak hundreds of different dialects. Their religions range from Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, Islam, to Christianity. Their cultures vary from India in the west to China and Japan in the east. Far from allowing themselves to be deterred by ethnic or political or cultural obstacles, Asian countries have put these issues in the pending tray and got on with developing economic ties. Common to all of them is a deep commitment to open economies and free trade, and an instinctive respect for self-reliance and hard work. This blend of pragmatism and enterprise has enabled Asian economies to become an economic powerhouse. It has also enabled them to become less and less dependent on the US and Europe for their main markets and look more and more to the region itself for growth. In the last 10 years, intra-regional trade has increased by more than 3 times. Hong Kong has led the way among Asian economies in one major respect: the astonishing development of the Chinese economy. Hong Kong has always been the first place within Asia to feel the first breeze of changing winds. A territory made up of nimble-footed entrepreneurs has its own inbuilt weather vane. And when China signaled to the world in the late 1970s that it was ready to do business again, Hong Kong was the first to respond. In the last 15 years or so, Hong Kong has grasped with both hands the enormous opportunities China's economic reform program brought. It is the largest investor in China, having contributed something like 3/5 of the $175 billion now invested by overseas companies in China's economy. The Pearl River Delta has been transformed as a result, and the development of the Pearl River Delta has in turn brought a new dimension to Hong Kong's own economy. One comparison illustrates this perfectly, I think. In 1979, Hong Kong manufacturers employed 879,000 workers. Today, they employ 5.4 million, of whom 4 million are in Guangdong province. As you will all know, in 27 days, Hong Kong will become a special administrative region of China on the basis of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. This historic and unprecedented event is finally upon us. Hong Kong's future political structures have been erected. The key political leaders are in place. Whatever one's view of the concept of one country, two systems, and let me say that I believe strongly that it is a workable concept, it is now time to look ahead. Before I tell you what my vision is of Hong Kong in the 21st century, perhaps you will let me first indulge in a few random and personal thoughts. The first point I want to make is this. Hong Kong people have always known that they are part of the Chinese nation, even though they may not wish to follow the same path as the mainland. And let me emphasize at once that I am not being chauvinistic, but I believe that this is an important factor why one can have confidence that Hong Kong will succeed as part of China. Chinese people are Chinese people, first and foremost. And communists, capitalists, and nationalists are a long way behind. Chinese people have, over the centuries, understood that life can be hard, that you can never afford to assume that peace and tranquility and prosperity will last forever, and that the struggle to succeed, to prosper, and to secure the fortunes of the family so that you will be revered by your descendants is one that you can never afford to give up. This slightly paradoxical combination of a strong sense of history and a strong sense of urgency lies at the heart of the well-deserved reputation of overseas Chinese communities throughout the world for hard work and success. This is why Hong Kong and Taiwan businessmen invest successfully in China when some multinational companies have found investment in China difficult. The extent of Hong Kong's influence over neighboring areas of China is not often reported in the outside world. The Hong Kong dollar has effectively taken over as the currency of the Pearl River Delta and circulates widely in Guangzhou and other cities. Approximately 20% of the Hong Kong dollar note and coin issue is circulating in southern China. Most of the 5 million people employed by Hong Kong capital inside China are paid the bulk of their wages in Hong Kong dollars. The Hong Kong banking system, down to ATM machines, operates inside China, with Chinese citizens having extensive Hong Kong dollar deposits. The town of Shenzhen, just across the border from Hong Kong, is virtually indistinguishable from the bustling new towns of Hong Kong's own new territories. It is possible to buy property, both for industrial and residential purposes, on the same leasehold system which operates in Hong Kong. Indeed, the Chinese government has consciously used Hong Kong's leasehold system as the model for developing their system of land use rights. A similar picture has emerged in Fujian province opposite Taiwan. The new Taiwan dollar is becoming as much the currency of the port of Xiamen as the Hong Kong dollar is the currency of Shenzhen. Many Taiwanese businessmen own apartments in Xiamen so that they have somewhere to stay when visiting their business interests in Fujian province. This economic community has been created by decisions taken in boardrooms, not in government offices, and is all the better for that. It is a manifestation of the ability of the business community to ignore, and in some cases, to bulldoze political and historical barriers. As a Chinese, I understand the need to lay to rest formally the bitter legacy of 19th century imposition of territorial demands on China. The Joint Declaration secures that purpose. But economic imperatives and the good sense of Hong Kong people have long made the borders between Hong Kong and the mainland irrelevant. To most Hong Kong people, 30th June is already here, and life after 1st July will be much the same. So what is my vision of Hong Kong? I see Hong Kong as the financial, shipping, and services hub of a greater China economy, which is spreading to include the coastal provinces of south of the Yangtze. I see Hong Kong continuing with a largely apolitical administration, more openly accountable for its actions in front of a lively and assertive legislative council, but one whose members are united in their support for the principles of free markets, the rule of law, and a clean and competent public service. I see a network of communications in the Pearl River Delta and further afield, which will cut journey times to sensible levels. I see Hong Kong people living in spacious homes inside China and commuting to work in Hong Kong on commuter bus and railway services which cross the border. And I see Chinese citizens living in modern, spacious homes in Guangdong province. I see the next generation of Chinese leaders tackling some of the structural bottlenecks in the Chinese economy with a progressive privatization of state-owned industries. I see lively and liquid markets for Chinese government debt, and in slower time, China's domestic equities. I see institutional fund managers working very hard to sell their services and investment products to the large number of high net worth individuals who will be found all over South China. It is a curious paradox that people in Asia have taken the process of economic integration across political and national boundaries further than in any other place. Although the triangle economies of Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South China is the most striking and the most advanced example of this trend, it is happening elsewhere in Asia too. Singapore capital has spread into neighboring areas of Malaysia and Indonesia. Thailand is a base for investment in the rest of Indochina. Even now, Vietnam is attracting a great deal of interest from overseas investors, and over $1 billion worth of foreign investments have already been authorized. Many people refer to the next century as the Pacific century. Now, what does the shift of economic power to Asia mean for the world? Indeed, what does it mean for Asia itself? I think there are four main areas to watch. First, there may be overheating in some parts of Asia in the short term. In the longer term, Asia will have to address some of the environmental issues that rapid growth has brought. The Asian Development Bank recently found that environmental destruction was costing countries of Asia anywhere between 2 and 9% of their GDP, and that 13 of the 15 most polluted cities in the world were in the region. The next phase of Asia's development will, I suggest, have to incorporate remedial factors to halt the trend of environmental degradation. Second, Asia's very success has produced a new generation of better educated and more articulate young people. Many of them are educated overseas. their aspirations will be different from those of their parents. The social and political dimensions of this development will need to be addressed. Third, China has a commanding role in Asia. Immense economic emancipation has taken place there in the last 20 years. It has brought a better life, a better standard of living for its people. The clock cannot be turned back, whoever is in power. The attitude of Western countries towards China has often swung from uncritical enthusiasm to blind condemnation. I believe that you achieve much more influence over China by doing business with them on a steady and consistent basis, always making clear that business must be done on acceptable terms. But it is in nobody's interest, especially not the 1.2 billion Chinese people on the mainland, to have a love-hate, on-again, off-again relationship with China. Western powers need to have a considered, longer-term policy on China. Fourth and finally, in his book Investment Biker, George Soros says, and I quote, "The best investment advice I can give to people planning for the 21st century is make sure your children learn Chinese. By the year 2020, the Chinese will have the world's largest economy," end of quote. I think the same goes for understanding Asia, if countries in the West are to fully exploit the opportunities there. The average citizen of the West still knows little of Asia. Asian people, on the other hand, are insatiable in their quest for knowledge and understanding about the West. There is an imbalance in the levels of knowledge between Asia and the West. I believe there is a case for enlightened encouragement in the West for deeper understanding of Asia. And for this reason, I thoroughly commend the LSE for their initiative in establishing the Sir John Bremeridge Chair. I suspect John Bremeridge would have been amused that the London School of Economics has established a chair in his name. For he was a humble man. At his first press conference as Hong Kong's financial secretary, he said, "I am just a second-rate, fat, colonial businessman whose wife thinks that I am not good enough for the job." He also had a healthy skepticism about economists. He believed that an economist's guess is as good as anybody else's. But he would have been very pleased, I am sure, that the Bremeridge Chair will stimulate debate an interest in that part of the world which was home to John for most of his working life and to which he contributed so significantly. I wish the Sir John Bremeridge Chair every success. Thank you very much.
Done very much that very elegant lecture. We have about 20 minutes for questions, and there is a roving microphone somewhere in the room for anyone who wishes to ask a question. Don't be bashful.
You spoke about the Hong Kong dollar circulating happily in China, and of the Taiwan currency also. In Europe, we are concerned with, or some people are concerned with, producing a single currency in order to produce a common market. In China, it seems that the common market is already there, and it doesn't give a damn about a single currency. Have you any lessons for Europe?
No, I wouldn't dare to suggest a lesson for Europe, but I would say that this example is a very good example of, I suppose, Asian pragmatism. When something is working very well, let it go on. And the whole process has started by a process of evolution from the beginning of the reform program in China, Hong Kong's investments into China that has led to the use of the Hong Kong dollar widely in southern China, at any rate. So it's worked very well, but it's worked well through a process of evolution and not by official edict.
Baron has done to say something about the economic influence of Japan in mainland China and in the region.
Well, Japan in the last 20 or 30 years has been a major investor certainly in Hong Kong. And in recent years, it has been investing in China. Japanese investment has been mostly in the service industries in Hong Kong. For many years, when I was chairman of the Trade Development Council, we often went to see ministers in Japan, hoping that we could encourage them to invest in Hong Kong's manufacturing industry and in developing technology transfer between us. But I mean, Japan is a major player in the region, both as an investor, and in recent years, as it gradually opens its own internal market, it has the potential of being a very important consumer market for manufactured goods in Asia as well as around the world. So it plays a key role in the economic development in Asia.
You spoke of the South China triangle, South China economy, Taiwan and Hong Kong, which would be a great growth region. Is it likely to create problems of regional imbalance regarding west and northern parts of China if the southern cone becomes almost an Olympic continent?
I think that if the success of what's happening in the southern part of China in economic terms, if that success is not spread gradually inland, then it's bound to create certain problems. At a practical level, you get a lot of people in China, which happens from time to time, flooding to these centers in the hope of getting employment. At the other level is you create inequalities which people would find politically difficult to accept. But what is very encouraging, to me at any rate, is to see that the developments are spreading inland, albeit it's going to take time. And Hong Kong investments Hong Kong investments are going further inwards. I think for China, it is it's a very important point. Leave aside the Hong Kong dimension, the Taiwan dimension, that that this development is gradually spread inwards.
A question at the back and then one in the middle. Take the one at the back first.
Baroness Dunn, what role do you see for Hong Kong as the international capital market for the whole of China after reunification, after the end of this month? Do you see the Hong Kong market providing the principal source for international investment in China?
Well, yes, I do see Hong Kong as a services hub, as I said earlier, for China. It, for all intents and purposes, it has served that purpose, that it has played that role in the last 10 years or so, and has been very effective at that. Hong Kong has the advantage of not just geography, not just constitutional tie with China, but expertise, contacts, and international investors feel comfortable dealing with China through Hong Kong. I think from that point of view, Hong Kong will continue to serve a very useful purpose in conducting capital. And secondly, of course, many mainland companies listing in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. There are some, I think, 26 mainland companies already listed in Hong Kong, raising international capital in that way. And inevitably, this trend is going to continue.
I have a question in the middle.
First, as somebody who's made relatively infrequent visits over the last 15 years or so to China, nobody could have failed to see the huge economic progress and the individual standard of living going up in China. But you mentioned something which certainly on my last visit struck me enormously, which is the pollution, the environmental side, which there have been very few of any laws. Now, in view of what you said about Chinese pragmatism, mm-hmm. I wonder what we would likely to be learning from ways of dealing with the pollution side of this huge boom, whether you could expand a little on that side.
Yes, my sense is that the Chinese authorities themselves are becoming aware of the problems of pollution. And there is a will to try and tackle this. But of course, like all things in China, it's such a vast country. And to do something like that, I think will require a lot of advice and expertise. And this is where I hope that Hong Kong too can play a role. Hong Kong itself has not had a good environmental protection record. It's inevitable that in a booming economy, you tend to worry about the environment perhaps least last. But Hong Kong has now implemented some good laws to protect the environment, and the environmental agency in Hong Kong is effective in implementing the regulations. One hopes that Hong Kong will have some influence, certainly insofar as southern China is concerned, because Hong Kong is now actually getting the pollution from across the border despite its own efforts. So one hopes that two sides of the border, the authorities on two sides of the border, will work together in that respect.
I think we had a question down here.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. Good evening, Madam. In your speech, you seem to be very optimistic.
Could you put the mic just nearer to you?
In your speech, you seem to be very optimistic with regards to Hong Kong's role after reunification with China. Now, what do you think Do you think the Chinese authorities share your same optimism? I mean, especially after the death of Deng Xiaoping, do you think they will continue to approach Hong Kong-China relationship in the same non-ideological, pragmatic way? And secondly, what, in your opinion, can the rest of Asia, specifically my country, Singapore, what can we do to encourage China to continue in this pragmatic, non-ideological way? Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, I think that the Chinese leadership is committed to implementing the one country, two systems concept. I think that they are not just keen, in fact, very anxious to maintain Hong Kong the way it is, because it is in China's own interest to do so. I mentioned the contributions that Hong Kong has already made in China's reform program. And once the political uncertainty is removed, the political dilemma, which has always dogged the Hong Kong-China relationship, once that is out of the way on the 30th of June, I see even closer working relationship between the two. China has a long way to go to modernize its economy. It's had great success in the South through Hong Kong's influence. But it needs Hong Kong not just its capital, not just its manpower, but its expertise, its infrastructure, its contacts with the rest of the world, all of those things. I think it's a very unique jewel that Hong Kong is to China, and I think the Chinese leadership will be very careful in handling this valuable commodity. What can Singapore do? I think Singapore's investing both in Hong Kong and in China vigorously. As I said in my address, this is the way I think Asians have been successful in putting ethnic or political barriers aside and get on with cooperating on the economic front, and everyone benefits in Asia.
We have a lot of people pressing questions. I think I'll just take two more and then draw proceedings to a close. I have one here, first of all.
It's Don. There's a widespread image of Hong Kong as a kind of society of blessings. Could you say something about the role of government in contributing to the success of Hong Kong?
The role of government in the success of Hong Kong in the future?
In the past and the future, you can.
Yes. I think the role of government in Hong Kong is to provide a framework and an environment which is inducive for people to invest. And when I talk about investment, it's not just investing capital. I mean, it's for people to invest their labor, for people to invest their time. And the Hong Kong government has an excellent record in providing that framework. Hong Kong has a very low tax, and the government only intervene when there is a social reason to do so. Otherwise, the government is committed to the market, the free workings of the market, as entrepreneurs and people living in Hong Kong are. And this is why one has seen so many companies who have done so well in Hong Kong, so many individuals. You know, one tends to think of a few mega billionaires in Hong Kong when we talk about the rich in Hong Kong. But in fact, every day, millionaires are being made from nothing. It's because the opportunities that the environment gives to people who are prepared to work hard. I have no doubt that the incoming government will continue to follow this non-interventionist policy. The civil service will be the same civil service as the one existing now, and the new chief executive, Mr. C.H. Tung, is a businessman himself who's done well in Hong Kong. So I have no reason to doubt that this the Hong Kong government will continue to operate on that basis.
Given the level of interest in the audience, I think perhaps if you'll forgive me, we'll take two more questions. I see two prominent hands, one here.
I understand you've given a very upbeat assessment of Hong Kong and its future. Many people believe that in addition to the various factors that you have mentioned as contributing to Hong Kong's success, is that there's also the question of civil liberties, free flow of information, free press, the independent judiciary, and so on. And many people seem to believe that these are under threat. And indeed, some people argue that the press is already, in some ways, circumscribing what it says. I wonder how far you believe that this is a problem, and whether you believe that Hong Kong will, in a way, overcome this problem.
The Joint Declaration is very clear, as is the basic law, in promising that the Hong Kong's existing freedoms will continue, and that includes all the freedoms that you just mentioned. The Joint Declaration, as well as the basic law, also have committed Hong Kong to continue to be a member of the two human rights covenants, United Nations Human Rights Covenants. So I have no doubt that these freedoms will continue. Having said that, I'm sure you are referring to recent debates about some amendments to certain ordinances. I won't go into the history and the details of that, but I do want to say that some of the headlines that I have read in the media here and elsewhere, where it talks about wholesale rolling back of Hong Kong civil liberties, are extremely misleading. All that these the recent consultation exercise that the new chief executive conducted was about whether there should be the amount of notice period to hold demonstrations, whether there should be an approval procedure, as this country follows, as indeed up until 1992 and 1995, Hong Kong had to do. So the second point about that exercise was that after the public consultation, where there was quite a robust reaction from the public on some aspects of the proposed amendments to these two ordinances, the new administration has watered down their proposals, and they've heeded the public reaction to that. So I do not see a wholesale rolling back of civil liberties. I think China totally understands that you cannot expect Hong Kong to continue to have a successful capitalist economy by restricting its freedoms. Capitalism simply would not work without freedoms. Secondly, Hong Kong is going to be run by people, all you have to do is read the names. Hong Kong will be run by people who are Hong Kong people, who were brought up in Hong Kong, who have done business in Hong Kong, succeeded in Hong Kong. Who are educated in Hong Kong. They understand the fundamental need and the values of a culture of freedom which they've always enjoyed.
I take one last question from the back.
What's likely to happen to the Hong Kong US dollar peg in the future? Will that be maintained, or will the Hong Kong dollar float free?
Well, the Hong Kong government has been very emphatic in making this very clear, that the link will continue. It has served Hong Kong very well, and there is no reason to change that.
Well, I think we'll draw to close. I've got a double vote of thanks to offer to Baroness Dunn. First of all, of course, for her inspiring lecture, which, as one can see by the many questions which are still lined up in the audience, provoked a lot of reactions. Second, however, Baroness Dunn and her husband done an enormous amount to support the LSE, both in Hong Kong and here, and I'd like to thank her on this double account. Thank you very much. I'd also ask you if you wouldn't mind to stay in your seats until Baroness Dunn has a chance to leave the lecture. Thank you very much.